yesterday, Scott Horton said that when he came to Mises, he had Institute envy. And I agree. Everyone that comes to Mises has Institute envy. So, and I just want to say, based on that, that I know Lou is sitting back there, and I don't know if he's been recognized this entire conference, but, I mean, it's all because of Lou that this is here. And, of course, you know, Tom and Jeff Dice have been great, but, you know, Lou's just fantastic. So I do want to thank you all for having me, and Tom for having me, and of course for the sponsors of the event. Today I'm going to talk about The Righteous Cause Conquers the World. Now, Dr. Nanjara talked about how this was an Orwellian kind of revisionism, and of course Tom discussed this treasury of virtue, but really what's going on is another kind of myth. Now, there are a couple of myths that work here. If you think about a myth, there's a couple of ways to look at that. A myth can be a true statement, or it can be a distortion of the historical record. And that's what our opponents mean by the lost cause myth. So we have two myths working in American history right now. One, according to the left, or even the West Coast Straussians or neoconservatives, is the lost cause myth, right? This is a pejorative. It's establishment academics say this is the wrong thing. Of course, underlying that is that slavery did not cause the war. Oh my gosh, I mean, it's all about slavery to them, and of course, the lost cause downplays that. Now, you have a number of historians who talk about this, again, in very negative terms. I list a few here: Heather Cox Richardson, Karen Cox, Professor Sinha, and of course, Heather Cox Richardson is on the record as saying the South actually won the war. Now, I've lived in the South a very long time, and I know a lot of Southerners, and I can guarantee if you asked a Southerner in 1865, did you win the war? They wouldn't have said, yeah, we won the war. Or if you asked a Southerner in, say, 1910, did you win the war? They wouldn't say, of course we won the war. Look around at America. It's all about us. Well, that's not true. Of course, they all say that the lost cause is a very dangerous myth with horrible consequences for American history. And of course, their myth is what I call the righteous cause myth. Now, you can say this is the treasury of virtue, but it is another kind of myth. To them, the war was a moral crusade to abolish slavery. From the beginning, it was always that. Sometimes they'll concede that, well, you know, I know that Lincoln said it wasn't about slavery at the beginning of the war, and we did have this congressional resolution that said this, but what about the Confiscation Acts? What about Congress looking to take slavery off the table for the South at the beginning? And what about all these abolitionists that marched off to war? Of course, it's about slavery. They also position this as democracy or republicanism against aristocracy and oligarchy or autocracy. Keep this in mind, because as we move through American history, this stuff is going to come up again, right? And this is accepted as a fact by establishment academics, pundits, and media. So the one is a dangerous myth, the other is a fact, right? So think about that. This is a very positive assessment of the war that's been buried by the lost cause lie. You see, all American history has been distorted by the lost cause. This real history has been out there. People just don't know about it because all these evil lost causers won the history wars. And again, I don't know how that worked. So which myth prevailed in American foreign policy and domestic policy, and who was actually lying? Well, I think you can guess which one I'm going to say is lying, but the righteous cause myth has actually been very destructive for the world. And I'll show you how. Now, modern American foreign and domestic policy is Republican foreign and domestic policy of the 1860s. And this does work hand in hand with the proposition nation myth, which, of course, they fit hand in glove. I mean, if you go to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, it begins this foundation of the righteous cause, which then it's the proposition nation myth, which then catapults into the rest of American history. So if you look at historians like Heather Cox Richardson or people like Matthew Karp, who is a historian at, I think it's at Princeton, all they do is simply regurgitate Republican Party talking points from the 1850s and 60s. That is their history. So they're saying that that's actually true and everything else was a lie. So when Dr. Njoya talks about Jefferson Davis, well, he was just lying. He wasn't telling the truth in these Senate speeches. All these other people were telling the truth, but he wasn't. So see, it's a conflict of which historical actors do we want to believe? Now, let's start with this definition of the righteous cause. And there, of course, is old Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. Amazingly enough, Charles Sumner was actually a protege of Joseph Story. And not a lot of people know that, but Joseph Story financed his European pilgrimage. So Sumner goes to Europe. He wasn't an abolitionist before he went to Europe, but he goes to Europe and he hangs around some abolitionists in London and other places. And he sees that, wow, this is the way forward. And of course, that was all paid for by Story. And if you don't know who Joseph Story is, he was a Supreme Court justice, wrote a very lengthy history of the United States Constitution, commentaries on the US Constitution, and it became kind of like the textbook for American constitutionalism. Story is considered to be an originalist, which is a distortion of that term, because Story actually inverted originalism on its head. He said, hey, look, all these opponents of the Constitution said the Constitution would work this way, and they were right. So that's real originalism, when in fact, that's wrong. They were all said, you're wrong, that's not true, that's not the Constitution as ratified, but that's what Story said was the real Constitution. And of course, people like Charles Sumner eat this stuff up. Now, Sumner is the most important figure in the creation of the righteous cause myth beginning in the 1850s. And that comes from his Crimes Against Kansas speech and other speeches. Establishment historians and West Coast Straussians parrot Sumner, it could be Sumter too, and their interpretation of American history. The war cannot be solely for the Union. It needed humanitarian justification. And when you go back and read Sumner, and of course he's whacked over the head with a cane several times by Preston Brooks because he said all kinds of horrible things about the South. But more importantly, people don't realize that speech was actually a personal attack. He and Butler were friends at one point and then weren't. And while he's making that speech, he's lisping through the speech because the senator that he's making fun of actually had a heart condition which caused him to lisp. And so that was the personal attack. It's what Brooks really took offense to and why he beat him over the head. So this is a speech from Sumner in 1866, a quote from a speech. He said, quote, a republic like a democracy cannot tolerate inequality. Now think about the proposition nation, all men are created equal, but this is factoring into this righteous cause myth. Wherever a favored class appears, whether in one or the other, its Republican character ceases. So if we have a favored class, you can't be Republican. And that would be news to John C. Calhoun, who always called himself a Republican. Southerners called themselves Republicans with a lowercase r. It may be an aristocracy or oligarchy, but it is not a democracy or a republic. Now think back to those terms, lost cause, righteous cause. The righteous cause people say we have republicanism and democracy against oligarchy and aristocracy, or autocracy. We're going to see that in World War I. It is not difficult to classify our rebel states. They are aristocracies or oligarchies. An aristocracy, according to the etymology of the word, is the government of the best. An oligarchy is the government of the few, and it is not even an aristocracy, but an abuse of aristocracy, as despotism is the abuse of monarchy. To show that our rebel states are aristocracies or oligarchies might suffice, but we must not forget that born of slavery, they have the spirit of that iniquity so that they are essentially of a low type. Clearly, most clearly, and beyond all question, such a government is not republican in form. Call it oligarchy, call it aristocracy, call it caste, call it monopoly, but never call it a republic. Now, as we go forward in American foreign policy, and we're talking about war, what does the United States often do? They have to classify everybody else as anti-democratic. It's not a republic. It's an autocracy, an aristocracy, an oligarchy. We have to take out these bad guys, Sumner is making the case for it. This is why they took out the South, because you see, it's not American. The South was never really American. It's the antithesis of American. That's why they had to go. This is the basis of American foreign policy. Now, of course, I put a little note down here. Massachusetts still had a taxpaying qualification to vote in 1860 and a $3 poll tax when Sumner made the speech in 1866, which is about $62, $24. So when he says that, hey, we're a democracy, we're in equal, but only some people can vote if they pay the tax. So these people are all hypocritical. Of course, that poll tax is abolished in 1890, but it doesn't matter. The little facts, don't let those get in the way of all your rhetoric. Here is our good friend Thad Stevens, the handsome man. He said Reformation must be effected. Reformation. The foundation of their institutions, both political, municipal, and social, must be broken up and relaid, or all our blood and treasure shall have been spent in vain. This can only be done by treating and holding them as a conquered people. Now, he's talking about Southerners, but could we not say this about any place the United States invades in the 20th century? This is the same kind of rhetoric that's used. This is why I said the righteous cause conquers the world. Reconstruction to Stevens was giving law to the vanquished and elevating the oppressed population or freedmen. And again, what do we do in all these places we blow up? Well, you have to give law to the vanquished. Those that are enemies have to be vanquished and given law, and those that we save have to be elevated. It's our policy. Now, what about economic aid to the vanquished? That wasn't done during Reconstruction, but we would do that in the 20th century. That would be the Marshall Plan and other things. So there were Southerners whose families lived through Reconstruction, and they took part in the post-World War II world. People like George Marshall and Cordell Hull. I mean, all these people recognized what Reconstruction did to the South, and so they wanted it to be a little different for the rest of the world, but still, we have this idea of giving law to the vanquished. This is the basis of American foreign policy, and you have to go to the 1860s Republican Party to find it. Now, this is a quote from a man named James Jefferson McCarter of Columbia, South Carolina, in 1865. He said this as Sherman's troops were burning through Columbia, South Carolina. It's the other part of Sherman's war on the, it's the war from the sea, not to the sea. Sherman goes all the way through Georgia, turns north, and then goes from the sea back into the interior of the state and burned everything there too. So he said this, just a man witnessing the event. He said, both officers and men seem to vie with each other in punishing this town for the prominent part she bore in the rebellion or revolution. They were all deeply imbued with the sentiment of union. This glorious union was consistently on their lips. Like the Crusaders under Peter the Hermit, they wanted to reestablish the union, even if by doing so they annihilated the present population. They want to give back the Union even if they annihilate the present population. Take our democracy or die. So the Crusaders wish to plant the cross of Christ on the Holy Sepulchre even if it costs the lives of myriads of men, women, and children. The Crusaders. And I'm going to have some images here where I show you how propaganda is going to play a role from this point forward and how this war has to be sold. The righteous cause has to be sold to Americans throughout the decades. This strange fanaticism pervaded the whole army from Sherman down to the meanest private in the ranks. Now, James Jefferson McCarter, by the way, was not a native of Columbia, South Carolina. He's actually from New Jersey. And here he is in Columbia, South Carolina at the end of the war, and he's saying, gosh, these Union soldiers are awful. Look at what they're doing. Which brings us to Thomas Nast and propaganda. Now, if you've never heard of Thomas Nast before, you need to know who this guy is, because he was the most important propaganda artist of the 1860s and into the later Reconstruction period. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt said Thomas Nast was our best teacher. Now, that's saying a lot. He's German-born. His father left Germany in before the revolutions of 1848, but certainly he was kind of a revolutionary. He wasn't one of the 48ers that so famously or infamously came over to the U.S. and joined the Republican Party, but he did love the Republican Party. In fact, he created several of our modern iconic images, including Santa Claus, the way we think of old jolly Saint Nick now. That's a Thomas Nast creation, as is the Republican Party's elephant. He was an ardent Republican, a unionist during the war. He hated Catholics. He hated Southerners. He hated Democrats. He hated them all. There's some very famous Nast images of Catholics. There's one that's very famous where you have bishops standing, or I'm sorry, school children standing on the shore, and you have bishops coming out of the waters with alligator heads, right? And they're going to consume these poor Americans on the shore. And then, of course, another one is an image of Boston during St. Patrick's Day, and you have all the police being beaten up with these Irishmen who look like gorillas. So he didn't like Irish people either. Now, he's fully invested in the righteous cause myth. In fact, he is going to make it so for the American public. And he's going to do so through something called the Grand Characterama. Now, we all like to go to the movies, and we have our motion pictures. In the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, you had these cycloramas. You had these rolls of paintings that were put up on a stage, and then they would roll them across the stage like this, and there would be lighting and music, and you would have a narrator. It was like watching a motion picture. One of the more famous individuals to do that was named John Banvard, and Banvard was from the North. He actually made one of these painting shows that he showed to the Queen, Queen Victoria, and he made a lot of money on this, tried to build a house. They called it Banvard's Folly in New York. He was going to model it after Windsor Castle. He went broke and ended up in the Dakotas. But one very interesting thing about Banvard, he actually made one of these motion pictures about the burning of Columbia, South Carolina. There's no evidence that it left of it. It's gone. And I actually called up to the Dakotas where he ended up, and I said, is there anything out there for this? Apparently it got stuck in a school up there, but nobody can find it anymore. So I would love to see that thing. But Thomas Nast made one of these too. And I'm going to show you here in a second a couple of the images from that Grand Characterama. Now, first, before I do that, here is one of his images of Santa Claus. And so you can see Santa sitting on the sleigh right there. If you'll notice, he's wearing the stars and stripes. You see, Santa Claus is a good Yankee who's bringing presents to the troops, and he's got a little Jeff Davis puppet there he's playing with. And of course, everyone's having a grand time with that. But Santa was a Yankee. And of course, the image that we have of jolly old Saint Nick, again, is a creation of Thomas Nast. So our holidays have been influenced by this man from Germany. But let's look at a couple of these paintings from this Characterama. So this is, you can see at the bottom, you have some crusading knights. These are the Union soldiers marching off to war, and you have Columbia there with her sword in the air. And this is a huge painting. It would have been, you know, at least 12 feet high or so across the stage. And as this thing rolls out, they're playing the battle cry of freedom. So this thing comes out, and the battle cry of freedom is playing. The lights are going, yes, and everybody starts to clap and cheer. And if you've ever read the words of the battle cry of freedom, it's written by George Frederick Root of Massachusetts. This is the northern version. We will welcome to our number the loyal, true, and brave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And although he may be poor, he shall never be a slave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. So we're springing to the call from the east and from the west, shouting the battle cry of freedom, and we'll hurl the rebel crew from the land we love the best, shouting the battle cry of freedom. Southerners don't love their land. They love it better. You see, Southerners can't love their land at all. They're just evil oligarchs that have to be done away with. This is another painting from this motion picture, The Last Ditch. And as they played this, or as they showed this, we play the tune just after the battle, which nobody knows anymore, but it's a kind of a remorseful tune. It's about, fallen comrades. But here you have Grant and Sheridan lopping off Lee's head, right? So here are these knights riding in, and there goes Robert E. Lee. His head is off with his head, right? So, and people would cheer, yes, we did. This is what we did. We vanquish our foes. They have to go. They're dehumanized. Probably the best expression of this in modern times is that film Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer. The Southerners are vampires. They're not even people. They're just, you dehumanize these people. Of course, we just had a couple of days ago, the plantation Nottoway burned to the ground. And if you've been on social media looking at that, people are cheering this. This is great. These evil Southerners get what had coming to them, right? The plantation burns down and we save the world. Now, I know Dr. Njoya brought up John Brown. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about John Brown just briefly, not directly, but some of the people that at least supported John Brown, like Samuel Howe. You'll recognize his wife in a second, but Howe was from Boston, lived till 1876. He married Julia Ward in 1843. And of course, Julia Ward Howe wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Now, Howe was a true believer in revolutionary causes. He fought for Greek independence in 1824. He fought in the French July Revolution of 1830. He fought in the Polish Revolution of 1831, the Cretan independence movement in 1866. This guy loved any revolution that he could get his hands on that would change the world, including, of course, the war in the South. He helped finance John Brown. He was an abolitionist, believed in women's rights, except for those of his wife, who he didn't want doing anything, and she was always mad about that. Apparently, they had a very contentious marriage. He also wrote the blueprint for radical reconstruction because he was part of the Freedmen's Bureau. The war had to be for humanitarian gain. And again, I'll bring this into the present day. Think about how we talk about war. What are we doing? We're not doing anything bad. It's not a war for bad things. It's always for a righteous cause. That's what war has to be. And it goes back to this. So here is our friend Julia Ward, again from New York. And in fact, the reason she was much younger than her husband. And apparently, when she saw her husband in his uniform fighting for Greek independence, she just swooned over that. Oh, this is the man I want to marry. He's out here fighting for these Greeks. Of course, she wrote the battle hymn, which is really the standard of the righteous cause myth. It is the basis of American foreign policy. If you think about the lyrics to that particular piece, and it's the music is John Brown's body. The story is they're out there watching Union soldiers parade around singing John Brown's body, and they thought, you know, that's okay. Well, we need something that has much more righteousness to it. And so she penned these words, and it became this great battle hymn of the Republic. And so some of the lyrics, he hath loosened the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. Of course, and that is what Americans are supposedly doing all over the world. To this day, we're fighting to make men free. She supported American imperialism after her husband's death as a humanitarian effort. It was always about humanitarianism. And this is what she wrote in 1894. So here we are before the Spanish-American War of 1896, but she's talking about other wars, other causes that the United States could get involved in the 1890s. She said, "It is right that America should become an asylum for the oppressed of all nations. I am glad there are so many Armenians in this country. You are our brothers now. I earnestly hope that we may be able to help you, and not only you, but the oppressed of all nations." Right? "I think that we, the United States of America, are now called upon to play the part of Florence Nightingale, to take our stand and insist upon it that the slaughter shall cease. Oh, let us give more, let us give money, let us give life. But let us stand by our principles of civil and religious liberty. I am sure that if we do so, we shall have behind us and with us that great spirit which has been in the world for 19 centuries past with ever-increasing power. Let us set up in these distant lands the shelter of the Blessed Cross and of all that it stands for, and let us make it availing once and forever." Right? So we're going to fight for all these grand, glorious humanitarian causes forever, and that is going to be American foreign policy. And then she said this in 1898, which, of course, is following the Spanish-American War. She says, "If we have sent our legions forth in the spirit of brotherly kindness to succor the oppressed, to deliver the captive, if we have fought for truth and right, then we should have conquered, even if the material advantage had remained with our adversaries." So if we just do all the right things as we go out and fight, we still conquer. I believe that we have so fought and so conquered. God has granted us as a people the supreme grace of rising up from our trade and money getting at the call of our struggling and suffering neighbors. The tyrannies of the world are mighty, but they are doomed, one and all. The more excellent way is to prevail. Humanity at last takes the field for freedom. This is in 1898 with the Spanish-American War, as we're going to help the poor, hapless Cubans and Filipino people that, of course, we're going to then control after we take those islands. I've tried very hard to find the right word for this hour, and I'm not sure whether it has been granted to me to say it, but this is my thought and my prayer. Let us, dear fellow country people, prove ourselves equal to this great occasion. Let our efforts and our sympathies enlarge with the enlarging area of our domain. Let our new conquest be to us a pledge of our endeavor to attain the true glory of nations, the right of beneficence, intelligence, and justice. The true glory of nations is the righteous cause. Now, Dr. DiLorenzo mentioned Oliver Otis Howard in his talk, so there he is. He was known as the Christian general, lost an arm in 1862, commanded the Army of Tennessee near the end of the war, and led Sherman's right wing during the March to the Sea. This is a true believer in the righteous cause. He helped codify the myth by writing several books in his post-military career. Andrew Johnson called him a fanatic, and he was right. This man was, by very definition, a fanatic. He was ahead of the Freedmen's Bureau from 1865 to 1874. He helped found Howard University in Washington, D.C., and he also led the United States Army against the Nez Perce from 1874 to 1877, which, of course, was essentially a genocide. But he's a Christian soldier, right? His Freedmen's Bureau legislation that he supported, which was drafted by Thomas Elliott of Massachusetts, a man Howard called wisely progressive. If he could not take two steps forward, he would take one and bide his time for further advance. That is the best definition of modern progressivism. We can't take two steps. We'll just take one, and then we'll let the Republicans say that, oh, that's a good idea, and then we'll take another step forward, right? This is what the Republicans do. They just keep buying into whatever the left discards. Elliott and Howard worked together to advance a type of humanitarian nationalism and by extension, a humanitarian imperialism. So humanitarianism is the selling point for international military and diplomatic objectives, all due to war, right? So there's a very long quote here, and I put it, it's two slides, but I wanted to show you, this is Howard writing in 1907 about his life. This is near the end of his life and in his autobiography. He said, this benevolence was extended yet more that the free inhabitants just emancipated might purchase the land at the expiration of their leases. This sort of legislation in 1865 was quite new to our government. It was the exercise of benevolent functions hitherto always contended against by our leading statesmen, even when providing for the Indian Bureau. The nation, as something to love and cherish and to give forth sympathy and aid to the destitute, began then to be more pronounced than ever before. The notion, I should say. This is what it had to be. We had to do these things as a government, not just here, but also abroad. Our attitude toward the Indians and General Grant's peace policy and in giving them land and severalty, our intention in Cuba and our subsequent neighborly action toward the people of that island, our national efforts to lift up the people of Puerto Rico, and our sending instructors in large numbers who set in motion the work of education in the Philippine Islands, these and other benevolences suggested by this reference make the people of today feel that we have a nation which cares for its children. A system will always suggest bones and sinews which make up the form of a man without a soul. It was always hard to love a government which theoretically was a mere machine and which could extend no sympathy to people in disaster, nor kindness to the impoverished. I think we are growing to cherish more and more the idea of a single name for the Republic, and we are fast assuming that America should be that name. Every day we hear from the North, South, East, and West an expression, I am proud that I am an American. It was in this spirit that my assistants, who in time became very numerous, and myself in the Bureau work, began and kept on the varied duties through clouds of misrepresentation. The reward, as we shall see, was in the vast work undertaken and accomplished in the interest of humanity. It's all about humanity. You see, it goes back to that one word. And because of time, I'm going to keep going on here. He said that in 1907. Of course, he's also thinking about the wars that had taken place before that. William McKinley, April 11th, 1898, and asking for a declaration of war against Spain, which, of course, is supposedly caused by Cuba and the problems in Cuba, which is why the United States sailed immediately into the Philippines. I mean, details, right? It's all about Cuba. Go into the Philippines. Okay. The forcible intervention of the United States as a neutral to stop the war, according to the large dictates of humanity, and following many historical precedents where neighboring states have interfered to check the hopeless sacrifices of life by internecine conflicts beyond their borders, is justifiable on rational grounds. We can do this because of humanity. First, in the cause of humanity, and to put an end to the barbarities, bloodshed, starvation, and horrible miseries now existing there, and which the parties of the conflict are either unable or unwilling to stop or mitigate, it is no answer to say that this is all in another country, belonging to another nation, and is therefore none of our business. It is especially our duty, for it is right at our door. You see, we can't say this is none of our business. This war in Ukraine is none of our business. Can't say that. It's about humanity. This war in Asia, it's none of our business. No, 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 it's about humanity. This is 1898. And of course, here we have a Louis Dalrymple drawing from 1899. And if you look at this particular drawing, you have Uncle Sam hectoring over the students in the front row. These are all the newly conquered peoples of the Spanish-American War. And behind them, you have all these students who are learning the great principles of American democracy. This is the title of this drawing is School Begins. You have, of course, in the back, you have the freedman there washing the windows with a big smile on his face. See, this is what I get, right? We get to wash the windows of Uncle Sam. And then you have the American Indian there reading the book upside down. Can't read that yet. And you have the Chinese getting ready to come in. They're trying to get in the door of this great school of America, right? And then a couple of the quotations here from the drawing. The Confederate states refused their consent to be governed, but the Union was preserved without their consent. This is a grand thing. We don't need consent. The U.S. must govern its new territories with or without their consent until they can govern themselves. And because we have to bring democracy against autocracy and oligarchy and aristocracy and all that grand stuff. And here is a campaign poster from 1900. The administration's promises have been kept. A just war has been waged for humanity. This is what McKinley said in 1900. A just war has been waged for humanity. It's not about taking Cuba and only giving it back in 1901 if we can intervene all the time. That had nothing to do with it. It's not about the Filipino people, our little brown brothers, as William Howard Taft called them, and giving them. I mean, it's not about that at all. It's about humanity, you see, which is why we kept fighting the Filipino people. Here we have 1896. This is what Cuba looked like before when it was democratic. And here we have 1900 when it's Republican. We have a run on the bank and then a run to the bank. We have Spanish rule in Cuba, which is concentration camps, and American rule in Cuba, which is farms and schools. You see, we're the good guys. This is what it's all about. This is Woodrow Wilson in 1917. We are glad now that we see the facts which no veil of false pretense about them to fight thus for the ultimate peace of the world and for the liberation of its peoples, the German peoples included, for the rights of nations great and small and the privilege of men everywhere to choose their way of life and of obedience. The world must be made safe for democracy against autocrats and oligarchs and aristocracies. You see, again, this is the way you sell wars. It all goes back to the righteous cause. We are but one of the champions of the rights of mankind. We shall be satisfied when those rights have been made as secure as the faith and the freedom of nations can make them. And you see, Wilson was keeping the world safe for democracy. Enlist to help him. Sign up. You have to sell it. Right? And let's go to World War II. As I know, we had a little talk about that this morning. Wow. There's St. Abraham telling you to buy war bonds. Because buying war bonds is making the world safe for democracy, you see? This is Henry Wallace, who was the vice president, of course, a communist as well, literally. He said, this is a fight between a slave world and a free world. In World War II, right, we have the slave world and the free world. Just as in the United States in 1862, we cannot remain half slave and half free. So in 1942, the world must make its decision for a complete victory one way or the other. It's all about the war again. You see, Americans are continually fighting the war in some way or another. As we begin the final stages of this fight to the death between the free world and the slave world, it is worthwhile to refresh our minds about the march of freedom for the common man. Now notice, it's a fight to the death, the free world and the slave world. The South was the slave world. So those are the enemy. Those are the bad guys. And of course, by default, then that would be everywhere else that the United States is against, you see. It's propaganda. It's how they use these things. The idea of freedom, the freedom that we in the United States know and love so well, is derived from the Bible, with its extraordinary emphasis on the dignity of the individual. Democracy is the only true political expression of Christianity. And of course, Abraham Lincoln knew all about the Bible. He did. Now, the righteous cause in the world, the Cold War, liberation for South Korea and the push for humanitarian aid there, liberation of Vietnam and the hearts and minds of the people. Remember, all these wars during the Cold War were sold on humanitarian impulses. Now, it's not to say that communism is good. It's not. But we had to sell it somehow to get people to go and fight and die in Southeast Asia. You have to do it. It has to be humanitarian. It's not about taking a territory or anything else. It's about aid. The Soviet Union, same thing. Support for communist revolutionaries in Africa, Zimbabwe, South Africa. We're still seeing that now, how that works out. Harry Truman in 1947. Our way of life is based upon the will of the majority, and it's distinguished by free institutions, representative government, free elections, guarantees of individual liberty, freedom of speech and religion, and freedom from political oppression. The second way of life is based upon the will of a minority, forcibly imposed upon the majority. It relies upon terror and oppression, controlled press and radio, fixed elections, and the suppression of personal freedoms. Does that sound familiar? I mean, last time I checked, the U.S. government had a lot of control over the press and the radio and other things. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. I believe that we must assist free peoples to work out their own destinies in their own way. I believe that our help should be primarily through economic and financial aid, which is essential to economic stability and orderly political processes. This, of course, is part of what was later called the Truman Doctrine, right? So here he is laying out a very Lincolnian vision of a Cold War world, or a righteous cause vision. And last couple of slides, there's George W. Bush in 2005. I don't think Tom was in the audience that day, but this is when he's dedicating this museum that Tom went to in Illinois, right? So he's there and he's making a speech April 19th about Abraham Lincoln. I'm going to read you a little bit of that speech because it says everything. This is the war on terror now. Lincoln's voice was silenced, but he, more than any other American, has spoken to all the ages, and his words have haunted and driven our history. The convictions that have guided our history are also at issue in our world. We also face some questions in our time. Do the promises of the Declaration apply beyond the culture that produced it, the proposition nation? Are some, because of birth or background, destined to live in tyranny? Or do all, regardless of birth or background, deserve to live in freedom? Americans have no right or calling to impose our own form of government on others. That's Rich from Bush. Yet American interests and values are both served by standing for liberty in every part of the world. Our interests are served when former enemies become democratic, conquer their neighbors. Our interests are served by the spread of democratic societies because free societies reward the hopes of their citizens instead of feeding the hatreds that lead to violence. Our deepest values are also served when we take our part in freedom's advance, when the chains of millions are broken and the captives are set free, because we are honored to serve the cause that gave us birth, the righteous cause. Sometimes the progress of liberty comes gradually like water that cuts through the stone. Sometimes progress comes like a wildfire kindled by example and courage. We see the example and courage today in Afghanistan and Ukraine and Georgia and Iraq. We believe that people in Zimbabwe and Iran and Lebanon and beyond have the same hopes, the same rights, and the same future of self-government. It's the righteous cause taking on the world. The principles of the Declaration still inspire, and the words of the Declaration are forever true. We will stick to it. We will stand firmly by it. Every generation strives to define the lessons of Abraham Lincoln, and that is part of our tribute to the man himself. None of us can claim his legacy as their own, but all of us can learn from the faith that guided him. He trusted in freedom and in the wisdom of the founders. That's funny. Even in the darkest hours, that trust has helped Americans carry on, even after the second day of Gettysburg, even on December 8, 1841, even on September the 12th, 2001. Whenever freedom is challenged, the proper response is to go forward with confidence in freedom's power. His truth is marching on, right? This is the righteous cause. This is fantastic. And you know, Heather Cox Richardson likes to stand up and say, Abraham Lincoln is our guy. I agree. Let him have him, right? And I'm going to end with this, and I'm only 2 minutes over. I thought I wouldn't get through all this. I had to go fast. This is a scene from a series on HBO called Generation Kill, and it's about the first invasion of Iraq in 2002. And 2003, and this is just a short clip, but there's one of the Marines riding in this Humvee. He's still living. His name is Brad Colbert, Iceman Colbert. And there was an embedded reporter from Rolling Stone magazine. This part actually happened. They're riding through here, and you see this Iraqi holding up his baby, and as the Humvee is riding by, and just listen to what the exchange is. It's very funny. So as the Iraqis holding the baby, he says, hey, we love you, we love you. Thank you, vote Republican. That's what I'll leave it at. Thank you, vote Republican.